Hello everyone, welcome back. This is Chander in Palo Alto.
Hi, this is Arna in Oslo.
And you're listening to Valley Nordic, a podcast about technology, business, and culture between Arne, who's a venture capitalist, and me, who's an entrepreneur. So thanks for joining us. And today we are going to talk about the IPO or upcoming IPO of the Ant Group. We chose this topic because it's complex, interesting, and this is going to be the biggest IPO ever in the history of mankind. And it's not happening in New York. It's happening in two stock exchanges. One or half of the money will be raised in Hong Kong and another half in Shanghai. So it has geopolitical implications and implications for tech, how governments work, what message China is trying to send to the world, etc. So it's a very interesting topic. What do you think, Arne?
Yeah, definitely. And it's, you know, as you said, it's not just the world's biggest tech IPO, it's the biggest tech IPO, or sorry, biggest IPO period of any kind.
Yeah.
So this is kind of exciting for a 9-year-old company.
Yeah. And so they're going to raise 34 something billion dollars at valuation of over 300 billion. And
yep.
It's unbelievable. So, you know, just 5 years ago, their market cap was 40 something billion. So it's almost 10x in 5 years. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a company that's raised $22 billion to get here. And the size of the company is essentially, you know, a 9-year-old company, the same size as JP Morgan Chase, which is, you know, one of the major banks in the US. Mm-hmm. And actually, JP Morgan was of such a size in American history at some point that it had to be broken off as a monopoly. So this is a big thing coming on fast, essentially.
Yeah. So to give people the history of the company, it's a spin-off from Alibaba, which is a popular app in China mainly, and some other countries in Asia, but mainly China, which is kind of eBay plus PayPal plus Amazon plus, I don't know, what else can you include there? It's a super app. We did an episode on super app. So when I was doing some reading on the IPO, I learned when they spun it off as Ant Financial in 2010 or 11, Yahoo owned like 43% of Alibaba. But in the new entity, they didn't give them any stake. So Yahoo lost out of, you know, this huge appreciation of capital over the last 10 years. And the story they made up was, so they didn't even tell Yahoo that they were doing that. And the story was that because Alibaba at that time wasn't registered in China, and to work with the government, they had to register this financial company in China. That's why they created that entity. But I'm not sure how real that was. It seems more like they wanted Yahoo out of this. So that's the history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think to bring a little bit more flavor to that, I mean, Alibaba, as you said, is sort of this big, big platform for commerce. And it's true that it's probably the biggest e-commerce platform in China.
In
but I would say it has a, well, yes, but it's sort of the dominant player alone in China, whereas that's not so clear outside of China.
Yeah.
That said, it's being used quite a lot outside of China as well, sort of as a wholesale portal to source lots of different kinds of goods.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, even if it's sort of the biggest in the world, but dominant in China, it's actually quite widely used outside as well.
Yeah.
And then, mm-hmm. yeah. And then actually they implemented initially something called Alipay, which was essentially a way of paying, suppliers on Alibaba. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a little bit akin to the role PayPal play in the early days, or not in the earliest day, but still reasonably early days of eBay. Mm-hmm. And secondarily, they also implemented, which was kind of the breakthrough feature, an escrow function. So you paid in the money, the supplier shipped you the goods, and then the money was released from escrow. So it was sort of a trusted third party in making trades possible. And that's kind of how they grew their user base. And then I think the whole idea was that because it became a financial or a payment solution, essentially, it was regulated, which is more regulated than normal trade. And that's why they had to work with the Chinese government to get the right licensing in place and so forth. And then, you can obviously speculate if there was other things going on at the same time.
Yeah. So that's what I found really interesting, Arne. So the original idea was to build trust. The Alipay was created as an escrow service, or I may be getting it another way around. But basically, it's China and it's online. People don't know each other, who they're buying from. So they created this escrow service where the merchant would ship you goods, and the buyer would put money in escrow. When they got the goods, the money would be released. So that's like origins of Alipay, which eventually became Ant Financial, and now it's Ant Group. They changed the name again. And think about, PayPal was bought by eBay, maybe to do something similar, but they're kind of losing. Apple Pay now processes more money than PayPal, so they somehow weren't able to, grow and as Alibaba Ant did.
Yeah, for comparison purposes, PayPal has 346 million active accounts, whereas Alipay has 730 million. Monthly active users. And my understanding is that they have 1.3 billion registered users on Alipay.
And another number which is mind-boggling about Ant Financial is they process $15 trillion in payments every year. 15 trillion. That's more than entire MasterCard worldwide. And it's like close to probably Chinese GDP. So you can see the impact, one company can have on the running of the country. They've changed how the country is run. And it's hard for people who are not in China to see the impact. What they do is, not just the payment. Payments are made with QR codes. So now if you go to China, instead of paying cash or credit card, you just use your Alipay or WeChat Pay. Those are the two dominant platforms. And you pay people with scanning QR codes from your phone, which is connected to your bank account. So credit cards are kind of cut off from this. So that's one function, but that now is kind of, I think, one third, I forget the numbers, of the revenue. It's low margin business. So most of the money they make now is peer-to-peer lending, peer-to-peer money transfer, insurance. They have, I think, the world's largest money market account. The government got involved. So what we hear in the West, what Robinhood is doing, what, say, Lemonade, insurance, the digital banks like Chime, like it's all of that is in one. You go to Alipay, they get you a loan, you can use it for payments, you can invest money, you can get insurance. So it's all financial products in one app.
Yeah, so that's correct. They built, you know, the user base based on the payment function, which is sort of the core function they started with, together with escrow, and that's about a third of the revenue today. But as you say, they have like consumer and business credit, you know, investments function and insurance functions in there, and in that context, Alipay works sort of as a storefront or customer interface. You called it peer-to-peer. I think essentially they're a storefront for a multitude of financial services to that use Alipay as a distribution channel, yeah, to deliver these services. So they're not just other consumers, they're also, you know, banks and other financial institutions that use storefront that Alipay provides.
Yeah, that's a very important point. So peer-to-peer, it is one, you know, let's say business segment, but I think most of the money they're making is from the banks. So it's kind of brilliant because they're not taking the capital risk. So when, you know, you're getting a loan from Alipay, it's on the books of a bank or the Ant, sorry, I keep on saying Alipay, from Ant Group. It's, they're not actually taking the risk. They are getting a commission from the bank, but they have the credit scoring system. I think it's called Sesame, et cetera, which banks can use to decide to give loan. So they're more in the, let's say, commission-based business, provide getting users to the banks rather than becoming a bank themselves.
That is, except from payment, that is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. I think for clarification, the company is called Ant Group, mm-hmm, but the app that users are called is still called Alipay. You know, even if they're sort of the distribution channel or storefront, if you like, because all the volume of transactions go through there, they have, you know, lots of data to do all kinds of analytics for, you know, decisions and risk management and so forth. So they provide a value add to the financial institutions that plug in here to make better business decisions as to, so they provide an added value in addition to just distribution.
Yeah. It's distribution and the, let's say, credit scoring. They don't have, in China, like in the US, we have credit rating agencies, FICO, there are two others, but basically, you know, a FICO score. So they have something, and Financial does something similar to that, so the banks can use that information to decide how risky the person is.
Yeah. So I looked into the numbers. You mentioned one number. I mean, they report the numbers in the Chinese currency, but I translated it into US dollars. And the payment volume, if at least at the current exchange rate, is actually 17.5 trillion US dollars. and they have a consumer credit balance of $243 billion, an SMB credit balance of $59 billion. There is $610 billion of AMU. So that's essentially saving and investments.
AUM, assets under management.
Yeah, AUM. Yeah, $610 billion. So that's the sort of the investment through the platform. And then there are payments of insurance premiums for $7.7 billion. So it's a staggering volume of financial services through its platform.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I remember the days just 10 years ago how people in the US used to say how China copies everything. But this is real innovation coming out of China. And, you know, the money, well, a lot of the US big companies invested before the IPO and they agreed to holding on to the shares for 50%, all of them 1 year and 50% in year two. So they cannot sell anything for the first year, and in second year they can only sell 50%. So a lot of the big US companies invested before the IPO. I have this here, Hero Price, Carlyle, Warburg,
and Silver Lake.
Yeah.
Minimum. BlackRock and Sequoia.
Huh?
Yeah, so and BlackRock and Sequoia. So it's kind of like a who's who of big investment firms from the US.
Yeah, Silver Lake also.
Yeah, yeah.
The minimum check was 500 million.
And then Alibaba still owns about a third and will do so even after the IPO because they're subscribing to shares. Whereas the founder of Alibaba will go down to a direct and indirect stake of 8% of the company. So this is one of the wealthiest people in the world. I can't remember whether he's the wealthiest man in China. I think so. Becomes clearly wealthier after this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And this is one country. You know, most of the business is just in China.
Yeah. But part of the plan with the new funding is to expand into overseas markets. And that's, I guess, when it starts to get tricky again about the geopolitics and who controls data and where are you licensed and what are you allowed to do and what sort of transparency is required. That's when it gets tricky, at least in a multitude of countries.
Yeah, yeah. I think like you may have seen India launch this API or payment rails, I forget the name, that all digital app companies have to use. And then Brazil is about to launch that. So I think their strategy is not to take the app Alipay there, but they're making investments in these companies. So they invested in Paytm, which is, I think, the biggest digital app or equivalent of Alipay in India, but not as many users, and other Southeast Asian countries. So the plan doesn't seem to be, you know, taking Alipay as is there, but investing in other places, providing expertise, how to manage data and more operations and scaling.
Yes, there is also a Nordic angle to this in that a Swedish unicorn that is getting better known across the world called Klarna. Mm-hmm. It's a company that's the main investor is Sequoia, and they are big in sort of payment processing and consumer credit. Mm-hmm. They have a different way of checking out transactions than the traditional rails for credit cards, and then they give consumer credit based on that. They're expanding into the US, but they're clearly much bigger in Europe and particularly in the Nordics. Mm-hmm. And Ant Group is a small owns a small stake in that company in Klarna as well.
Wow. Yeah. So let's talk about the political angle. So I think if you're following the news for last year or so, there were big concerns in the West, especially that Hong Kong may not be the hub for Asia for finance, which it has been for decades because of the riots and I forget what's the name of the law that they can arrest anybody in Hong Kong and take them to China. I forget.
Yeah, I can't remember, but it's clearly a clampdown on freedoms in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
By the Chinese government.
Yeah. So there have been protests for, you know, years, and the big concern in the West was, okay, now they will lose the financial hub in Asia, which has been Hong Kong. So I think this is the way for Chinese government to show it is still the hub. The world's biggest IPO ever is happening in Hong Kong. Hong Kong and Shanghai. But the message they want to send out is not much has changed. Stuff is still happening there. And the US You know, it used to be everybody around the world wanted to do an IPO in New York, either NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange. But now we see that has changed. And it, in this case specifically, Ant Group or Ant Financial tried to buy MoneyGram, which is a US remittance company. So you can use MoneyGram to send money to other countries. And US blocked that. So because it's related to finance, it's, well, and, you know, US-China relations as well. So that might have been other reason they didn't want to do it in the US. But I think I read in one of the articles, Jack Ma said, even 3 years ago, it was unthinkable for him to do this IPO in China. The world has changed a lot in 3 years.
Well, that's assuming that Jack Ma is in a position to decide where to list. You know, there has been a lot of you know, writing about you know, his dependency on staying on good terms with the government in China as well. So I guess that's a separate discussion.
Yeah.
I think though, it, you know, what's kind of interesting is, so it seems like, you know, biggest IPO ever and the valuation of the company, it seems so big, right? But if you look at the size of the business, mm-hmm. I looked at that and looked at the metrics of the business, mm-hmm. and you know, the revenue over the last 12 months is about $18 billion. The year-over-year growth is 38%.
Wow.
And the ARPU is about $14 per year per registered user. And I think there's lots of, and operating margin, when you look at the operating profit, is 34%. So the metrics of this company at this scale is absolutely fantastic. And it's a highly, highly profitable company. Yeah. As opposed to some of these companies that have been going on the New York Stock Exchange and so forth lately. And so all of that leads to the company being, you know, price sales 17, which to me is cheap for a company like this. If you look at purely the business metrics compared to what it's been, you know, Snowflake was, you know, trading at up to 158 times mm-hmm. sales, and it's massively losing money and at much smaller scale and at a much more niche market. Of course, it was growing faster, but I actually think if you just have to look at the business metrics, mm-hmm. this is cheaper than the listings that you have seen in the US. And now, of course, you can ask, why is that? Is that because, you know, is that because the pricing is different in Hong Kong and Shanghai? Is it because, you know, the price is discounted because of, you know, concerns about political interference, or that it cannot grow outside its home market because of this, or that we can't trust the accounts because that has been an issue with companies listed in China or something? So I think there's some level of discount related to distrust here, mm-hmm. even if it's valued at this price and at this size of an IPO.
Yeah, you're right. But I think you see, it's a lot of, you have to write the $500 million check to participate before the IPO, which a lot of people, you know, I forget, it's over 10 billion, I think, money that went there from the US. So a lot of people see that what you're saying, it's kind of discounted. But I don't really know much about the Chinese market, because most of the retail banks, etc., they may not be as, you know, risk loving as the US ones, or optimistic that the growth will continue, since they already have 700 million users. And so I don't know, but that's a good point. It's not as expensive as it looks if you look at the numbers and compared to the other IPOs in the US.
Yeah, so I mean, the company, the number of total raised money before the IPO is $22 billion. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how much came from the US. But, you know, the way that I think about it is, yeah, so if you look at China in this isolation, there's probably a limited number more users you can get on there. But I think you're essentially only at the beginning of what you can sell to them, because you have their wallet on there and they need credit and they need insurance and they need savings. Mm-hmm. And that value of each customer, I think, is more than $14 a year.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. But we don't know, you know, if the average amount that people are saving is, you know, $4, then maybe not. So we don't know, or at least I don't know.
I don't know either. It just seems to be, despite the size of it, actually reasonably priced compared to some of the other IPOs. And then, of course, it's a different market and a lot of factors that are beyond the pure financials and the metrics of the company.
In, you know, being in Norway, can you buy stock in some Hong Kong exchange through your broker, Arne?
I believe you can buy, regularly traded shares on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. What I'm not sure about is the exact mechanics of subscribing to the IPO itself. I think that is a specific process, and I would assume you can if you're sort of a larger investor. But sometimes on IPOs, it's blocked off from certain regions. So, for example, yeah, it's easy for me to or at least reasonably easy to try to sign up for an IPO in Oslo or in London, but not in the US, because those are separate markets. And likewise, the US citizen would typically be blocked from subscribing to an IPO in Europe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are sort of regulatory islands, mm-hmm, and both from financial markets, but also from sort of data protection laws and these sort of things. But Hong Kong and Singapore has historically been very open marketplaces, and I think traditionally it's been easier to there have been less restrictions. But I wouldn't know how to go about subscribing at this IPO exactly without doing more research.
And you didn't want to write a $500 million check and participate in pre-IPO?
Want. I don't know if that was the issue.
You see, all these regulatory issues apply to people who are not rich. If you have $500 million, you bypass all that. You go and sign and buy anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. So other important thing I want to cover is just the operation of the company and the app. How closely aligned is that with the government? So for example, if your Sesame score or the credit score within the app is above certain level, then you can travel to other countries with whoever China has agreements with, basically you can travel without a visa if you have certain credit score. And if you don't pay if let's say you're a peer-to-peer lender or not lender, but receiver, and you didn't pay back the loan, then you're kind of, when you get a phone call, when you call somebody, there's an announcement that goes in, oh, this guy did not pay his loan back. So things like that. So they're using, you may have heard about the social score in China. So if you are in good rating, you pay all your loans back, then maybe you get like a better train seat when you book a train ticket because of your social score. So all that is closely aligned with government. This would never fly in the US. I don't know if in Norway, but this level of, you know, working closely with government on implementing these type of things where privacy is kind of non-existent I don't think it'll work in the US.
Well, it wouldn't work in Europe either. I mean, both in the US and Europe, you have like credit scores that deals with financial items, and that is, you know, fair and accepted. But social scores that include, you know, behaviors and beliefs and other ways of obeying government would certainly not be accepted.
Yeah. So let's for a few minutes talk about the risk. So we love the company. We, you know, I think they are discounted. We would buy it if we could, or shares in it. But what are the risks? One I see is the government just, you know, deciding they, you know, China is launching CBDC, that's central bank digital currency. So that may do something to their model, or the regulation may change. But outside of that, what risks do you see, Arna?
I haven't really studied the risks of it. I mean, there is competitive risk. I mean, the big competitor is WeChat. I think it's quite frankly in the interest of the Chinese government to have this company and Tencent work side by side in an orderly fashion and according to their wishes. So I don't see those sorts of, it's more like the geopolitical one. I think it's going to be harder to expand, at least with you know, the full service portfolio and at free reigns. Mm-hmm. So I think there's more a risk around slowing growth, and then being disrupted by the next innovation. I mean, 9 years ago, these things didn't exist in China, and things move faster. What will come up this year or next year or the year after that makes this irrelevant? Although I think, I believe this is a good business that will be around for quite a long time.
Yeah, and for reference, WeChat or Tencent, which is their competitor, Arne mentioned, they have even more customers. Their customer base is over 1 billion. So basically the whole country uses it. And Alipay or Ant Group, we mentioned, is 700 something million. So there's room for growth there too. They can grow up to over a billion. Yeah.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah. Before we end today, is, I don't think this has happened before, but the big four tech companies in the US, Apple, Google, Amazon, and Facebook, or GAFA sometimes, they're referred as, they're all announcing earnings today. Do you recall if all four of them announced on the same day before?
I have no idea.
Yeah, so it's big day for earnings. I haven't looked at the stock market today. Do you know how it was doing?
I have not followed it. It's up, but it seems to be reasonably uneventful so far.
Yeah, I'm just looking. NASDAQ is up 2%, most likely because of this earning. People are expecting positive earnings from these companies. Yeah. Well, thanks everybody for joining.
Well, before we end, I have a plea that's not meant to be on podcasts for technology and all of these things, but I'll do it on my own account. Tuesday is an important day. It's the presidential election of the US. And on my own account, I will claim to represent the free world from Oslo and plea with any American to make a good vote and make a vote for reestablishing the value of truth, science, democracy, and not for fascism. Help us out and rejoin the free world on Tuesday.
Yeah, thanks for the Arne. I would say, you know, just vote. Whatever your party affiliations are, let your vote count.
That is fair enough. But yeah, the outside world wishes for the best.
Yeah. And yeah, by the time we talk next week, the world may be different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks, everybody. And thanks, Arne. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.